Active Learning at the University of Vermont's Larner College of Medicine, an interview with Dr. William Jeffries, Senior Associate Dean for Medical Education. Welcome to the 226th episode of Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" Not only in, but in at the best program for you. I recently saw an NPR clip about a highly innovative approach to medical education launching with this year's entering class at the University of Vermont's Larner College of Medicine. In a nutshell, the goal is to eliminate lectures. The head of this initiative, Dr. William Jeffries, is our guest today. Dr. Jeffries is the Senior Associate Dean for Medical Education at University of Vermont's Larner College of Medicine. He earned his PhD in pharmacology from the University of the Sciences in Philadelphia, then went on to serve as Associate Dean for Creighton University, and arrived at UVM in 2009 and has served since then as the Senior Associate Dean. He was also on the board of the IASME, the International Association of Medical Science Educators, from 2008 to 2015. And he is the co-editor of the book, An Introduction to Medical Teaching, where he authored the chapter on lectures, the mode of teaching that he now wants to eliminate. Dr. Jeffries, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you.
Delighted to speak with you today. Can you give us an overview of the three major levels of UVM's curriculum?
Certainly. The first portion of the curriculum is called Foundations, and that is geared towards establishing the scientific basis of medicine. And students progress through that curriculum, which takes about 15 months, in which they learn a lot of basic science in a medical context. That's followed by the clerkship level, which is about a year long. And in that level, the students rotate among the traditional medical disciplines such as medicine, surgery, obstetrics and gynecology, psychiatry, pediatrics, etc., and really get a firsthand look at all of those disciplines and help care for patients and learn the art and science of medicine in that context. We have an alternate version of that clerkship level called the longitudinal integrated clerkship, which is a variation of that, and some of our students can opt to do that as well. And in that model, they follow all of the same learning objectives, except the students are embedded in a primary care practice, for 1 year. And all of the patients that they need to satisfy those objectives come from that practice, and students manage a panel of patients for an entire year under the supervision of a preceptor. The final portion of the curriculum is called Advanced Integration. And in Advanced Integration, students do a combination of required and elective courses that are designed to help them specialize or understand what type of residency they're going to have and also achieve additional learning objectives in the clinical arena.
And about how long is the Foundations portion of the curriculum?
Foundations last from August of the first year until the end of January of the second year.
So it's a little less than 18 months, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But there's a three-month vacation in there as well, so it ends up about 15 months of instruction time.
And is there clinical exposure during the Foundations portion, and is there classroom learning during the clerkship portions of the curriculum?
Yes and yes. In Foundations, we have a very rigorous clinical skills component where students interact with standardized patients. They also learn a number of important clinical skills. And then there's a integrated community preceptor experience called Doctoring in Vermont, where students work in a primary care, ambulatory care setting over the course of the first 2 years in Foundations.
So they get clinical exposure very early on at UVM.
The first student see a patient is the first day of orientation.
Can't get much earlier than that. Now, I saw, I don't know if it was on that NPR clip or somewhere else, that you have a stated goal of eliminating lectures by 2019 and substituting active learning. Let's start first with a very basic question. What is active learning?
So active learning is the process of putting the learner in a situation where they're basically compelled to apply knowledge to solve problems. And so very often it's done in a group context, but it doesn't have to be. So essentially, I guess a way of looking at it would be if you had to memorize the map of Burlington, Vermont, and that would be, say, the part where you learn the information. The application of that knowledge would be I would ask you to drive to a specific address based on that knowledge. And so that's the difference. The memorization of a map would be a sort of a passive learning event, and the application of that knowledge is really the active learning portion.
Okay. And you are the person who literally wrote the book, or at least a chapter, on effective lectures in medical education. Why dump lectures?
Well, there's nothing wrong with lectures as a as an information delivery unit. I mean, they are effective, and it's the issue is that it's a difference between a knife and a food processor. You know, you can in fact chop vegetables with a knife very well. It's just not as efficient and not as easy and efficacious as using a food processor. So we've determined through the literature that lectures, although they can be useful to deliver information, are simply not the best way to learn. And in a medical curriculum where you are faced with an onslaught of increasing amounts of medical information every day, as of 2020, the amount of medical information in the literature will double at a rate of once every 73 days.
Wow.
It's simply impossible to tell students everything that they need to know. But we have to focus on the application of knowledge, the processes involved, and allow students to develop the tools that they need in order to be effective physicians. Lectures are not the best way to do that, and we know that active learning methods are better at promoting retention of knowledge, and also promoting the development of knowledge at higher levels of learning, not just remembering, but actually synthesis and application are encouraged by active learning. So that's why we want to use it.
And you gave the map example, you know, which is a very easily relatable one. Can you give an example, like, you know, sometimes I'll hear about systems-based learning, or I'll hear about problem-based learning. Are those two kinds, or is active learning, can active learning be applied to either of those two approaches to medical education? Are both those approaches aspects of active learning?
Well, all of the alternatives to lectures that are out there are definitely usually attempts to improve the active part of the equation.
Right.
So I think that, for example, problem-based learning is certainly active learning, and in which students actually develop their own learning objectives and work on problems in groups to develop their understanding and knowledge of a particular medical problem, an entire area of medical knowledge. So those types of examples are in fact what we want to move to and help to help our learners to develop greater depths of learning.
Can you give an example? I mean, like, I can. There was a clip on your website that I saw about, you know, diagnosing appendicitis.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. And again, it was very relatable. But I'm wondering how, and I unfortunately, I do not have a strong science background. How would this work if you're teaching, you know, the basics of pharmacology, for example, you know, where the maybe the principles, the connection between the principle and the ultimate use of that principle is not so obvious?
So in pharmacology, I'm a pharmacologist, so it's very near and dear to my heart. Sadly, in medical education right now, the students in particular have been driving a derivative approach where they say, just let me know which drugs are on the test and then what aspects of those drugs will ultimately be on the test. And so you can look in study aids that are available commercially or ones that are produced by the students themselves, which basically reduce all of pharmacology to a table. And in one column is the name of the drug, and the next column is the mechanism of action, and then the indication and the side effects, et cetera. And that's great. I mean, it does, in fact, catalog all of the major categories of drug action, but it's completely incomprehensible a month from now or at any remote time from when you've memorized that table. You know, your brain can only hold so much unrelatable information. So a better way would be to have students develop a table like that from their own notes or the information that you've provided to them, and then use that table to solve problems about patients or drugs, et cetera. So there's many examples of this, but unless you start applying the facts and relating them to your current body of knowledge and really creating internal stories about how to remember this information, but also why it makes sense and why it's relevant, you're not going to have long-term retention. And this is important to have this long-term retention for the practice of medicine, but also because board licensure exams and future certification exams rely on you to remember this information and apply it. And the other thing is, we know that in medical practice, physicians are walking around applying knowledge that's in their head all day long. And that is the value of these physicians to society. So the earlier we encourage students to do this and require them to focus on an active learning approach, the better off they will be, but also the better off their patients will be.
Makes sense to me. Also sounds like it would be just much more fun and engaging, frankly.
It's more fun and engaging for everyone. You know, the teachers, once they start to get into this and stimulate individual students' knowledge base and curiosity, you can get addicted to it. And pretty soon you really don't want to teach any other way.
Actually, one of my questions is, how are students and faculty reacting to the change?
So I think any change, of course, is going to create a negative feeling because the right now students and faculty both have a reason to like lectures. Lectures are the easiest thing to deliver and develop, and most faculty already have a lecture in a PowerPoint that's in a file stored on their computer. So they just have to modify that and to redeliver it every year. And there's no extra development. And in fact, many faculty, like myself included, like standing up in front of the class and seeing their faces and telling jokes and relating things that you're an expert in and being having an uninterrupted story about the importance of your particular area of interest.
And maybe telling the same joke you've told once a year for X years.
Oh, yeah. Well, I like to tell different jokes, but I can, you know, you can hear the same joke. You know, we podcast our lectures, so you can hear the same joke from year to year to year in many different podcasts. And sometimes the same lecturer will give the same joke in two different lectures, which they don't even remember they do that, but the students sure do. But from the student's perspective, the faculty member is getting up there and you automatically have a boundary placed around what the examination will cover. And so you know that the lecture will produce the examination question. So it's a guide to the test. And then what you can do is work on reducing that lecture into a series of important points that will likely produce a question that is going to be on the exam, which is great. But the problem with that is, of course, that you're really training the students to study for the exam rather than working on the material to benefit patients in the future. And they're just two different endpoints. And I think that we want to focus on the patient, not on the test.
So, I mean, can you give me like, what is a classroom like? Let's say you're, all right, you know, you can, I guess, put out a certain scenario on some classes and say, you know, diagnose this patient or what treatment would you recommend? That was the example given in the little clip that I saw. But in other cases, would it be collectively working on a, let's say, a particular aspect of gross anatomy and dissection, or would it be solving a certain problem? I mean, there are different types of active learning, right?
Yes, so in our curriculum, we're kind of coalescing around five different methods, and problem-based learning, which you alluded to before, a problem-based learning discussion, which is a much more abbreviated case-based small group discussion, laboratory, and a team-based learning, and a thing called objectives in action, which is our version of the flipped classroom. So we have those five methods that are used. And so a typical one, for example, team-based learning that we use, it's a very specific method. And so let's say students would be given a reading or a video on a particular aspect of liver pathology, let's say. Mm-hmm. And they would study that at home and learn some of the facts about liver pathology. And then when they arrived at class, the first thing that would happen would be they'd get a 10-question quiz on the facts around the liver and the liver pathology. And they would be straightforward facts. We're not asking them to solve any problem. Just remember the material.
And then to make sure that they have a basic foundation, I assume. Would that be the goal of the quiz?
And it's really to assure that they did the work. Uh-huh. And once the students have finished answering those questions, and they're difficult questions, so the class average is usually around 60%, then the students take the exact same test in a small group of six. And they work through that, and the group is allowed to answer once for each question. So everyone has to have the same answer in the group. And then when they pass in those grades, the scores are typically about 95%. So the students have done some amount of peer teaching in that group, and everyone's knowledge base has sort of moved up so that they understand all the facts. Those two grades are included in the final grade for them for the course. So it does count, and they need to do those in order to proceed. After that, then the students will work through individual cases about liver disease. And so patients will be introduced. They will have perplexing problems with their liver, and the students will then have to, by group, come up with the correct answer or diagnosis or treatment or whatever it is. And all of the groups report their answers simultaneously. And if there's discrepancy in those answers, then that creates the impetus for a discussion about why an answer is correct or incorrect. And it allows the instructor to register the class as all having the same amount of problem solving and remembrance of the correct approaches to studying liver disease. When you do an approach like this, it turns out that the students have very little studying to do after this. The students tend to remember this very much these approaches and the cases and the answers and the, but more importantly, the logic behind them. And when you give them examinations, even if you have a much higher level of expectation on the exam and much higher amount of cognitive processing expected, the students do just fine on those questions. What they don't do as well is on questions where you've only lectured and then asked them to solve a problem. They just really don't have that capability.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about occasionally helping my grandson with math, or my husband usually does it actually, but sometimes it's like he just wants to get the problem done. And my husband is an actuary by profession, and he wants him to understand the mathematical principles behind it. This was also with our children when they were young. And he's like, no, just tell me how to do it. Just tell me how to do it.
I recognize that medical students are fully formed adults, but actually that is a human trait, not just a child trait.
Right. Right, it's a child.
Have your taxes magically done? You would want that to happen.
Yeah, but I'm not sure that you necessarily have to understand. I don't think there's anything, unless you're an accountant, that you have to understand the whys behind the tax code. You know, I think if you want to understand math, you have to know the principles. If you want to be a doctor, you certainly have to understand. You can't just memorize stuff.
Well, adults learn in context. So if something appears to be an esoteric concept, but you actually will need it later, it's incumbent on the instructor to make sure that the learner understands the application that's going to be necessary. You don't want to just say, you need to know this stuff, and that's just it. You really want to say, okay, being able to calculate renal clearances is important because we need to do this when a patient has renal disease because it affects the amount of drug that appears in their blood when you're giving them treatment. You know, if you don't understand that impaired renal function changes the amount of blood drug that appears in your blood, then you're really not going to be a very effective doctor. So you need to not only just know that fact, but also be able to calculate the effect of diminished renal function on drug availability.
Has there been any, I mean, I know that this year you're moving, I think, entirely or certainly by 2019 to an entirely active-based learning approach. Has there been like a transition? Are you seeing perhaps when you were on the way to this approach that, you know, USMLE scores went up, that matching results improved or anything like that? Students were happier. I don't know about professors because now they have to prepare each time. Might be more work for them, but what kind of on the way to this point in time have you seen in terms of results?
Yeah, well, what we've seen is when we first introduced, for example, team-based learning, we were able to compare scores on exams from the previous year to the current year when the for questions that were directed at the exact same base of knowledge. And what we saw was an increase of about 3 points in their grades on their examinations that covered these topics.
You mean the school exams or the USMLE exams?
This is the school exam. Mm-hmm. The USMLE exams are much more difficult because the USMLE exam does not allow for direct comparison among questions. Uh-huh. What they will give you a score that is based on the standard variation of the standard deviation from the national mean in subject areas. Mm-hmm. The problem is the subject areas are all based on individual disciplines like physiology, biochemistry, et cetera. And our progression through the act of learning has not been restricted to one versus another one of those areas. We're sort of evenly going across. So it's difficult to use those data to compare our improvement to the national basis because quite frankly, the numbers are all indices. They're not actual numbers. They're not actual measurements.
Mm-hmm.
They're derived parameters, and I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's quite perplexing to look at the.
It sounds very perplexing.
Yeah. And the thing is, I've never, in all of my time, I've never seen a score that was reported by the USMLE that was different. The variation was different from the mean. So the data always come back that you're normal.
I see. All right. But
with respect to our own internal exam, we have seen improvement of scores when we switch a teaching session to an active learning session, when we use the same assessment tool for both types of things. And actually, there's a lot of data nationally on this. There's a paper that came out in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2014 by Freeman et al., which looked at 225 individual studies of the application of active learning, and they looked at two things. They looked at the grades, and they looked at failure rates in courses that had either changed to active learning or had a side-by-side comparison of active learning versus lectures. And what they found in those studies was that there was about a 1.5-fold increase in the score over the standard deviation. Mm. So there was about 1.5 standard deviation increase in the final score in grades of courses that had introduced active learning, and a reduction in the failure rate. So the bottom line is that there's pretty good evidence from 225 studies that you will improve your grade and reduce the rate of failure in courses that use active learning versus lecture.
That's pretty compelling. What kind of less in terms of statistical measures in terms of in grades and test results? What about in terms of student satisfaction? Have you done any surveys or anything like that, which I guess still is statistics, but a little bit more qualitative kind of assessment?
Yeah. So we're in the process of actually studying that right now, because as you can imagine, when we've taken an approach where we are not transitioning entire courses over to active learning, we're just changing the courses over time all together. So components of courses are going over. But the fact is that one of the courses that we've really focused on moving is a course called Nutrition, Metabolism, and the Gastrointestinal System. And the course ratings have, since we've introduced these active learning methods, the course ratings have gone from the mid-2s to the mid-4s out of a 5-point scale. So I think that the introduction of active components to the course, where students are actually doing something, they come to class and there's new activities to do as opposed to sit in a chair and watch lectures, has been a tremendous increase in their course rating.
Okay. All right. And then how is the new approach affecting admissions and affecting what you're looking for in terms of the students?
Well, we recognize that, if a student is looking for a traditional lecture-based curriculum, our medical school is going to become less and less attractive looking to them. Although I would say to that student, you are really a victim of your own biases here about lectures versus active learning.
Yeah.
We know that every student does better in active learning. But if this isn't your cup of tea, that's fine. There's about 140 medical schools out there. So we're only just one of them, but so that's the first thing. But the second thing is we have changed specifically our admissions process, and so we've gone to a multiple mini interview methodology. And I imagine you know what that is.
Yes.
Having an admissions podcast. And the stations in our MMI are centered around the competencies of our curriculum. So we're really looking for students who are well suited to thrive in an active learning environment and who will not be disturbed by it, and students who work well in groups and students who have a particular aptitude for this type of learning.
Okay, great. That, yeah, I can see where the MMI would also just make a lot more sense with the kind of learning that you're doing, especially with team-based learning. Should, just getting back to the more traditional criteria for medical school, should applicants to UVM, is it important for you that they have both clinical and research exposure prior to arriving at UVM?
Sure. I think that's important because students need to know what they're getting into. And you know, I used to interview medical students under the old format. They don't trust me to do it anymore, and I don't blame them. But what I would say is, you know, tell me what you think a doctor does, you know, all day. You know, what is this profession about? And so it's important that they understand that. And the best way to do that, of course, is to have a significant amount of medical experience. But also, you know, you're kind of expecting a fair amount of devotion to service and altruism, which again can be seen by community service, and so that's an important component as well. And then, of course, we don't want to we like to have people who want to take care of patients. That's a wonderful thing, but we recognize that there's a scientific basis to medicine, and so having research experience, of course, is a great demonstration of that, and it helps the student understand not just that science is about memorizing a bunch of facts, but it's also about development of new knowledge and the development of that curiosity that really drives medicine forward.
All right. Well, it seems like you're driving the approach to medical education forward, that's for sure. And obviously research does the same with just the overall bottle of medical knowledge. Now, getting back to the whole admissions aspect of this podcast. Last year, UVM received 5,975 applications. It interviewed 619 applicants and it ended up with a class of 117. I know that the mean MCAT score for entering students is 512 and the average GPA is 3.82. But I suspect more goes into the process of getting that class of 117 people than just the MCAT score and the GPA. How on earth, going beyond MCAT and beyond GPA, how on earth does UVM winnow that class down from 5,975 to 117?
Yes, it's not an easy process. And we have a really great admissions team here that works very hard on this, and a number of devoted faculty who are on the admissions committee who really do a great job and put in a tremendous amount of work to get it done. But there's a number of steps along the way, and I'm not on the admissions reports to me, but I let them be the experts here. So I apologize in advance if I leave out any steps or have a misunderstanding of how we actually do it, but we look at the applications. So there's 6,000 applications roughly to go through, mm-hmm. and we have a screening process which involves looking at the MCAT, obviously, and the undergraduate GPA, but also the other things that we already talked about, the accumulated experiences that really make students unique and stand out. We also look at diversity, and because we know that we want to have a diverse class, and that patients out there tend to look for diversity in their medical team, and more appropriately relate to physicians who have identities similar to their own. So we want to have a diverse group. We want to have a group that has demonstrated academic achievement, et cetera. We also have a process that students are now going through where we give them a questionnaire as part of the secondary application, and students log in online and answer some of those. And we also have a couple of essays, one of which relates to diversity and how the student plans on contributing to the diversity of our environment here. From that 6,000, and there's a pretty rigorous pruning of the group by more than 90%. That's using those criteria, and there's some simplifying the process tremendously here. But
sure,
students are put into different pools, whether or not they're from the state of Vermont, because we're a state school, so we have a group of students that we want to take every year from Vermont. Most of our students come from out of state, however, so
yeah, I saw that.
They're in the general pool, and we. Then do an invitation for students to come here based on that a ranking that allows them to distinguish themselves into the top 10% of that applicant pool. From there, the students come to Vermont and do the MMI. At that point, their identities are sort of hidden in terms of just their name. All of the information that got them in the room is set aside, and the MMI is now the consideration of how we're going to distinguish among these students. The students go through the MMI stations. There's 9 of them. They have to answer questions around 9 different scenarios that are presented to them. And they get 6 minutes to do that to independent evaluators. The evaluators don't talk to each other about the questions, and each evaluator covers a single question. So if there's 36 interviews that day, one evaluator does 36 of the answers of the same question and ranks students, or I shouldn't say rank, but rates students based on a I think it's a 10-point scale on their answer with a narrative response.
Is the MMI the decisive factor, or after the MMI and does the admissions committee meet and consider the ratings and the MCAS and the secondary and everything altogether?
The latter. So what happens is that the students are then receive scores for the MMI. The MMI score is then used in a holistic way. There's also another exercise that happens during the admissions day,
okay.
And that is a teamwork exercise where students are given a task to work on in a team, and independent raters are looking at their certain criteria that are unknown to the student, but while the students complete a team task. Those scores as well are looked at and help rank the students in terms of who will get an immediate acceptance versus who will become on the wait list versus whose application will unfortunately be rejected. And in that way, and we have an ongoing or rolling process, so the number of outright acceptances is lower than you would expect because in the initial part, because we recognize that this is a rolling application process and we want to have the final. There's still places available in the class during the final admissions interview day as opposed to the first one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So at any point in time, if you interview it at UVM, it is possible to get accepted. It doesn't matter whether you do it in August or whether you do it in April.
That is correct. That is correct. And that's important. You know, we often hear this, the students tend to, or the applicants tend to, fill in knowledge gaps with rumor and innuendo, there is no secret to the process. It's as I described just now, and the students. We want to make sure every student gets a fair shake, so that they are screened in that way.
Okay, all right, great. Thank you. That was a very thorough answer. How can students, and we've been talking about the active learning, we've been talking about the admissions process at UVM, how can students, and here I mean, let's say, not people applying right now, people may be thinking of applying in 2018, 2019, be they in college, out of college, how can students prepare themselves for active learning environments, for doing well in an active learning environment?
Well, I think in the teaching of science, a lot of our universities are headed that way already. So they're going to see those types of approaches in their undergraduate environment. I think that the main thing to remember is that you learn through questioning and through building of new knowledge by taking recently encountered facts and trying to make sense of them with respect to the old facts that you have stored in your brain. So that means that you you need to take out the knowledge and practice it, answer questions about the new knowledge, and continue to rehearse your ability to think and recall. I recently heard a very wonderful presentation from a researcher by the name of Jeff Karpicki, and he's at Purdue, and he talked about, he studies how people retrieve information from their brain. And he found in his research that retrieval of information is really a specific process that is better done by some methods as opposed to others. So he asked the simple question of the audience: how do you study? How many of you study by rereading the old material? And most of the people raise their hands. And he says, in fact, we find that 95% of our research subjects study by rereading the old material, and more than 50% use it as their primary study method. But his research showed that rereading the old material does not improve test scores at all. So when he gives experimental subjects a test or a reading to do and then gives them a test on it, they get a score. And when he gives them the reading and then gives them the reading to read over again and gives them a test, they get the same score. If he gives it to them to read three times, they get the same score. So he said that this is what cognitive psychologists call labor in vain.
Yeah.
That studying by rereading is actually an enormous waste of time. It doesn't help you at all. So if that's the way you study in college, you're really not improving your ability to succeed in the college you're in, but it also provides you with zero advantage in an active learning environment. What you want to do is to do questions on that material immediately, and then a few days later, and a few days later, and really focus on recalling that information and in different contexts. You know, so if you remove the information from your brain and apply it to a different set of circumstances or problems, you'll remember it much better and at a much higher level, and you'll always have that information to use. So that's the key that I would say for students that are out there right now. Study in a way that makes sense. Don't study in a way that doesn't make sense. And you'll have better scores. That means your MCAT will go up. That means your GPA will go up, which makes you a more attractive candidate to most medical schools. But also it will put you in a position to succeed in your studies and succeed in active learning. And it'll give you more time to do other things like community service and medical service and research.
Wonderful answer. Thank you so much. It really was a great answer. I assume that part of your answer to my next question was encompassed in the answer to the last question, but if there's anything you want to add, what advice would you give to applicants planning to apply to UVM in 2018, in the upcoming cycle? Not this cycle anymore, again, the upcoming cycle. So let's say they're a college junior now, or they're maybe a senior planning to take a gap year. Maybe they're already out working, planning to apply next summer. What advice would you have for them?
I would say be yourself and be excellent in something. You know, we're not looking for jacks of all trades here who say, well, I did research and then I did this and I did this. What we want is people who have some level of commitment to something and they are really focused on taking that drive that they have and bringing it to fruition in some way. So I founded a program that does this, or I was the valedictorian for my class, or I went to Tibet and helped refugees or whatever. Those types of things are the things that make you stand out as an applicant. And you know, as I said, there is no specific formula for who is an ideal candidate for medical school. You should have the minimum qualifications, obviously, and beyond. But the most important thing is that you have evidence that you have a dream and you're following it.
Okay. Thank you. So follow your dream. Any question you would have liked me to ask? That's a freebie.
I'm losing my voice, so I think we'll be good.
All right. Dr. Jeffries, I think we're almost out of time and you're almost out of voice. This has been just delightful. Thank you so much for joining me today. Where can listeners learn more about UVM Larner College of Medicine?
Our URL is www.med.uvm.edu/admissions.
Sounds good. We'll link to that from the show notes at exhibit.com/226. And that way, listeners, you can learn more about UVM, its innovative curriculum, as well as other resources that we're going to provide that may be helpful. Listener, thank you, too, for joining us for this, our 226th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, please subscribe. Make sure you don't miss any future shows, be they with deans, admissions directors, professors, current students, test prep pros, or alumni doing great things. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.